regardless. Since she left office, Hillary has used the fact that because she was involved in the process, she can't talk about her views on the Keystone Pipeline. As she told one crowd, "I've said before in Canada, as I've traveled around your country, avoiding answering questions about the Keystone Pipeline, because I really can't, having been part of the process." So, her involvement prevents her from talking about Keystone, but it didn't prevent her husband from making millions from its largest shareholder. As Charles Kalamoris, a professor of financial institutions at the Columbia University Graduate School of Business, explains, the speeches were not really about speeches. What they really wanted was to buy Hillary's goodwill by paying Bill. "I'm not sure it would matter if those speeches had taken place in Clinton's bathtub," he said. "What matters is that they paid him." While much of the media attention to Clinton speaking is focused on his fees from Wall Street and pharmaceutical companies, it has been the outsized payments from overseas that have really brought in the money. In 2011, Bill Clinton made $13.3 million in speaking fees for giving 54 speeches. But of those speeches, paying $250,000 or more, $5.1 million of those fees, nearly 40%, came from just 11 speeches given outside the United States. Overall, these mega-paying speeches for over $250,000 generated nearly $40 million in income for the Clintons from 2001 to 2013. In short, Bill Clinton's best years, with much higher than average fees being consistently paid by foreign entities, occurred while his wife was at the pinnacle of her power as Secretary of State, a perch with enormous influence over issues that directly affected foreign governments. A few examples make the point. Beginning in 2009, the Swedish telecom giant Ericsson came under U.S. pressure for selling telecom equipment to oppressive governments, some of which used those technologies to monitor and control their own people. In late 2010, the SEC sent a letter to Ericsson about sales to countries that were considered state sponsors of terrorism by Hillary's State Department. The regimes included Sudan and Syria, where Ericsson sold and maintained telephone switching equipment, and Iran, where it was selling commercial-grade systems to public network operators for mobile communications. Hillary was a well-known hawk on Iran and used economic tools against regimes that were considered sponsors of terrorism. According to U.S. diplomatic cables, State Department officials were regularly and increasingly raising these transactions involving Ericsson with the Swedish foreign minister. In April 2011, Ericsson was named in a State Department report for supplying telecom equipment for the oppressive regime in Belarus. Separately, on Capitol Hill, pressure was mounting, and a bill would later be introduced in December 2011 in the House of Representatives to stop the sale of surveillance technologies to repressive regimes. In June 2011, the State Department started drawing up a list of which goods and services might be covered under expanded sanctions on Iran and other state sponsors of terrorism. Meanwhile, Ericsson decided to sponsor a speech by Bill Clinton and paid him more than he had ever been paid for a single speech, $750,000. According to Clinton financial disclosures, in the previous 10 years, Ericsson had never sponsored a Clinton speech, but now it apparently thought would be a good time to do it. On November 12, 2011, Bill appeared at a telecom conference in Hong Kong and talked in general terms about the role that telecom plays in our lives. 1 week later, on November 19th, the State Department unveiled its new sanctions list for Iran. Telecom was not on the list. On December 8th, Hillary discussed the issue of telecom companies and their sales to repressive regimes for the first time since Bill's speech. She argued that companies like Ericsson needed to make good decisions about whom they do business with, but proposed no further action. In April 2012, President Obama signed an executive order imposing sanctions on telecom sales to Iran and Syria, but those sanctions did not cover Ericsson's work in Iran. The Swedish company said that it was planning to scale down its work in the country because of public pressure. But internal documents obtained by Reuters found that the company planned to honor existing contracts in Iran. In 2011, much of the Arab world was in upheaval, dealing with the aftermath of the Arab Spring, which had sparked widespread protests across the region. In Egypt and Tunisia, large crowds took to the streets and demanded political change. Many of these protests turned violent. Even countries considered relatively stable, including Bahrain and Yemen, were dealing with violent upheavals. the events left small but wealthy countries like the United Arab Emirates feeling very vulnerable. The UAE was being pressured by the United States to tighten its grip on economic ties with Iran. In May, two oil and shipping companies faced sanctions for their trade with Iran. On June 20, 2011, the Obama administration designated six UAE-based shipping firms for sanctions over their business dealings with Iran. 3 days later, the United States charged several other parties in the UAE with trading parts for fighter jets and attack helicopters to Iran. The UAE was in a precarious situation because it feared the Iranian regime, but it feared something perhaps even more, being abandoned by the United States. In a secret State Department cable, the Crown Prince said his country was being left out of our U.S.-Iran sanctions consultations. He explained to a visiting congressional delegation that the royal family was left wondering what will happen to them in any deal the U.S. and Iran reach through back-channel conversations. Amid this uncertainty, the royal family decided to pay Bill Clinton $500,000 to come and speak in Abu Dhabi. Bill arrived in Abu Dhabi and stayed at the Emirates Palace Hotel. His speech was on collecting environmental data. "The lack of environmental data hurts," he said. "On top of all environmental issues, the financial crisis is making the world's stability even worse. The only way out, though, is a green economy." What is striking about the speech is not what Clinton said, but the timing of the payment. Even as Bill was being introduced to the audience by the Crown Prince of the UAE, the prince's brother, the foreign minister, was en route to Washington for meetings with none other than Hillary. Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan arrived in Washington on December 12th and met Hillary the day after Bill collected his $500,000. Based on Clinton's financial disclosures, it does not appear the UAE royal family had ever paid for a Clinton speech before. This was not the first time Bill collected large checks for speeches paid by foreign governments, such as Thailand and Turkey. It certainly wouldn't be the last. The year 2010 was a tense time for U.S.-Chinese relations. The problems were piling up. The Chinese government reduced its military ties with the Pentagon following U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. Google disclosed that it had been a victim of a Chinese cyber assault. Barack Obama hosted the Dalai Lama in Washington amidst public outcries in Beijing. Relations grew stiff when officials disagreed on trade issues and China's alleged manipulation of its currency. Meanwhile, China was flexing its military muscle, sending a submarine to the bottom of the South China Sea where it planted a Chinese flag on the ocean floor to signify China's claim to the mineral-rich area. At the center of U.S. policy toward China was Hillary Clinton, who was the architect of the Obama administration's strategic pivot to Asia. At this critical time for U.S.-Chinese relations, Bill Clinton gave a number of speeches that were underwritten by the Chinese government and its supporters. That might not be apparent if you look at the Clintons' public financial disclosures. For example, on October 21, 2011, Bill gave a speech before something called the Silicon Valley Information Business Alliance in Santa Clara, California. But who underwrote the speech? According to correspondence between Bill's office and the State Department, the co-sponsors were a coalition of Chinese government entities and organizations. Bill received $200,000 for the speech, well above his average for speaking in the United States. And the sponsors were the China Electronic Commerce Association, an entity launched and chaired by an official from the Chinese Ministry of Information Industry, the Suzhou People's Government, a municipality around Shanghai, the China Association of Science and Technology Industry Parks. This third sponsor sounds pretty innocuous, but it's a government-run entity in China. And the California State Friendship Committee, a small California-based organization designed to foster U.S.-Chinese relations. There were no clear guidelines about what was and what wasn't permissible. After the speech in California, Bill Clinton's office contacted the State Department and sought approval for a speech sponsored by the Shanghai Airport Authority, SAA. Note the flexibility and lack of understanding that it had already approved the speech in California when the State Department wrote back. "Your correspondence states that the Shanghai Airport Authority, a state-owned enterprise, would be a title sponsor only. Does this mean that SAA is not contributing any funds to pay for President Clinton's fees? I don't believe we've previously cleared acceptance for fees from PRC-linked entities, but could consider this variation." the State Department Ethics Office was willing to consider a variation on guidelines, they wrote to Clinton's office. Ultimately, Clinton declined the speech. His office said there was a scheduling problem. Bill also took a $550,000 payment for an appearance in Shanghai at something called the Huatuo CEO Forum, underwritten by Chinese billionaire Yan Zhihe, a man described as China's baddest billionaire builder. Yan has become wealthy in part through large government construction contracts. His company is perhaps most famous in China for lopping off and flattening 700 mountaintops for a construction project. Yan says in defense the number wasn't quite that high. Yan, who calls Clinton a close friend, is an outspoken Chinese nationalist, explaining that foreign countries must not look down on China. I understand that my country, my nation, China, is the greatest in history. Prior to Hillary's appointment as Secretary of State, Bill had given only two speeches on the Chinese mainland for a total of $450,000. After Hillary's appointment, the Clintons promised both the incoming Obama White House and the U.S. Senate that his speeches and business ties would be vetted by the State Department Ethics Office, as described in Chapter 1. This approach was doomed to fail, because the disclosures to be made were not required to indicate anything other than the name of the donor, certainly not investments or business they might have with the State Department. An examination of the communication between Bill's office and State Department ethics officers, which was obtained by a judicial watch through the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, indicates that Bill Clinton's office never provided anything but a cursory description of who was paying for each speech. TD Bank's ties to the Keystone Pipeline, for example, were never disclosed. Erickson, in the correspondence concerning that speech, is simply described as a world-leading provider of telecommunications equipment. No mention is made of its tangles with the State Department at the time, and the department green-lighted 215 speech-making arrangements as not posing conflicts of interest. For the ethics officers replying to the Clinton requests, the emphasis was on a speedy response. And then there was the intimidation factor. They were vetting speeches being done by the spouse of their ultimate boss, and the spouse happened to be a former president. For good measure, all correspondence pertaining to Bill's speeches between his office and the ethics office was copied to Cheryl Mills, Hillary's chief of staff and Bill's longtime friend. And who ran the ethics office at the time? That would be the State Department legal advisor Harold Koh, who had previously been appointed by President Clinton as Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor. Speaking of ethics problems, some of Bill's largest paydays for speaking fees have come from scandal-plagued Nigeria. As we will learn in the next chapter, the Clinton financial ties to the continent of Africa run deep and often include those with troubling reputations and rich histories of corruption. Chapter 8. Warlord Economics. The Clintons to Africa. It was an unusually hot July in 2009 when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton landed in Kinshasa, the sprawling capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC. The DRC, previously named Zaire, had for decades been a house of horrors, ruled by corrupt dictators, populated by child soldiers, plagued by tribal fighting, and suffering from invasions by neighboring countries. Few places on earth are more hellish than the DRC. As a senator, Hillary had taken the lead in rooting out DRC corruption and violence. In 2006, she was one of the first to sign on as a co-sponsor of the Democratic Republic of Congo Relief, Security, and Democracy Promotion Act of 2006, one of only 12 co-sponsors in the Senate. The legislation, which was authored by then-Senator Barack Obama, included provisions on human rights, corruption, and sexual violence. It also addressed the issue of conflict minerals, the illicit trade in valuable minerals that fuel much of the country's violence. The bill had teeth, giving the U.S. Secretary of State real power and authority to combat the country's problems. The bill was passed by the Senate and House, and President George W. Bush signed it into law. Hillary was also a vocal supporter of the Enough Project, an initiative launched by the Liberal Center for American Progress. The project called for an international certification system that would require DRC mining companies and end users to account for their minerals' origins. A similar program had been established several years earlier for the diamond trade. Soon after Hillary arrived in Kinshasa, former NBA star Dikembe Mutombo, who was from Congo, took her on a tour of a hospital built in honor of his late mother. Mutombo worked with both the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Global Initiative, CGI, on projects in the region. Hillary spoke with students about her commitment to helping Congo turn things around. "We know that the promise of the DRC is limitless," she told them. "We will help you build a strong, civilian-led government that is accountable and transparent." From Kinshasa, she hopped aboard a UN plane, her U.S. aircraft was too big, to visit President Joseph Kabila in the eastern city of Goma. There, she talked about efforts to reduce the rapes and sexual violence that had terrorized the population. She talked about the lucrative mining trade in the country, too. "I am particularly concerned about the exploitation of natural resources, like the mining and the timber, where the resources do nothing to help the people of this country," she said in front of the international media. Her words were strong, but her actions during her tenure as Secretary of State came nowhere near the positions she had taken while in the U.S. Senate. As one scholar from Johns Hopkins University put it, the law she had co-sponsored was never implemented by Secretary of State Clinton. Furthermore, in 2011, the DRC government held national elections that were widely condemned, but the State Department showed little interest in trying to remedy them. When the Congolese government changed its constitution mid-election in favor of President Kabila, the State Department called it an internal affair. When the United Nations group of experts linked Congolese militia groups with the neighboring government in Rwanda, it was proof of Rwanda's military intervention into Congo that had contributed to hundreds of thousands of deaths. Some have asserted that Hillary's State Department sought to block or delay the publication of the damning portion of the investigation and, quietly, asked Rwanda to stop its support for the rebellion. What happened between 2006, when Hillary took those strong positions, and 2009, when she became Secretary of State? Did she change her position? And if so, why? We can't ultimately know why she carried out the policies that she did, but we can notice where changes in policies conformed with the interests of Clinton Foundation large donors. On January 20, 2007, Hillary Clinton sat on a gold-colored sofa in her Washington, D.C. home and announced via the Internet that she was forming an exploratory committee and filing with the Federal Election Commission, FEC, to seek the presidency. "I'm in," Hillary declared, "and I'm in to win." Poll numbers gave her reason to be confident. With George W. Bush's poll numbers in a free fall, there was a sinking feeling in Republican circles that the GOP would have a hard time keeping the White House. And among Democrats, Hillary was the early frontrunner. Pundits, pollsters, and the American public were not the only ones paying attention. Hillary's announcement, in the weeks and months to follow, sent a cascade of foreign dollars flowing into the Clinton Foundation and into the Clintons' own pockets. Significant funds came from foreign investors with massive investments in troubled corners of the world. Securing access to African business opportunities had often required paying bribes to government officials. Now these investors were looking for access and political cover at the highest levels of power in Washington. A few months after Hillary's presidential announcement, on July 6, 2007, the Clinton Foundation announced that a reclusive Swedish mining investor named Lucas Lundin was committing $100 million through a charity called Lundin for Africa. According to the announcement, the Lundin for Africa commitment will be aimed, in large part, at approved projects in Africa where the Lundin Group has significant mining, oil, and gas interests. Lundin lived in Vancouver, Canada, and used a series of offshore trusts to manage his business affairs. A friend of Frank Giustra, Lundin was the head of a sprawling enterprise that cut deals with African warlords and dictators to gain access to valuable minerals and oil. As one longtime observer put it, the company pursued a strategy of operating in countries under sanctions and building assets in countries such as Libya, Iran, and Sudan, where many other competitors were unable to operate. This kind of business could be enormously profitable if you were willing to look the other way on corruption and human rights. But the strategy also posed enormous risks. By 2007, when he made his commitment to the Clinton Foundation, his company was under considerable political and legal heat in the United States and Europe for some of its business dealings. The Lundin Group was one of only two Western oil companies drilling in the Sudan. which was not only the focus of media attention for massive human rights violations, but was also on the U.S. State Department's list of terrorism-sponsoring nations. Human rights activists were pushing for pension funds to divest stock in the company. Even more troubling, the Lundin Group was under investigation by the International Prosecution Chamber in Stockholm for complicity in war crimes and crimes against humanity. In 2012, the chief prosecutor decided not to press charges. In announcing the donation to the Clinton Foundation, the family's spokesman explained, "This is not to soothe a bad conscience, but we want a positive impact in countries in Africa where mining is conducted." That may be true, but it does not explain why the Clinton Foundation saw fit to accept such a large contribution from such a questionable source. The Lundin companies were founded by Lucas's father, Adolf, who had made a lot of cash mining in apartheid South Africa after the United Nations applied international sanctions. While other companies had fled the country in the face of international pressure, Lundin stayed. When Adolf died in 2006, Lucas continued where his father left off, working in the darker corners of Africa, where few companies ventured. The Africa Oil Corporation, in which they owned a controlling share, was active in Ethiopia's Rift Valley, a region run by a corrupt dictatorial regime. Lundin also had a spin-off called Horn Petroleum that was drilling in Somalia, even though the government there collapsed in 1990 and the country was essentially run by warlords. Lucas Lundin was also chairman of a company called NGX Resources that was mining in Eritrea, a region that was attempting to break away from Ethiopia. The company also had a heavy stake in gold mining operations in Mauritania and Ghana. But perhaps the most lucrative mining operations in the Lundin portfolio were in the war-torn DRC, which has known more death, corruption, and fighting than perhaps any other area of Africa. The Lundins got their foot in the door by striking a bargain with a Marxist warlord. In early 1997, the Congolese rebel leader Laurent Kabila, who had once worked with Che Guevara, was in the middle of a campaign to overthrow Mobutu Sese Seko, the country's longtime strongman ruler. To finance his rebel campaign, he sent a representative to Canada to talk to mining companies about investment opportunities. His proposal was simple: give me money, and I will give you lucrative mining rights in my country once I seize power. One of the first to bite was the Lundin family, which signed an agreement with the rebels and provided them with most of the funds they needed to march into the capital. The Lundins reportedly paid $50 million to Kabila's finance minister, the first installment of $250 million they gave to the rebels. The rebels wanted cash and, by all accounts, didn't know what they were doing. Kabila's minister of mines, Kambale Mututulo, had never seen one. "He asked us to send some books on how to run one," noted one executive who met with him. For the Lundins, this was an enormously lucrative opportunity. "There are moments in the history of mining when you can make deals like this under excellent terms," said Adolf Lundin at the time. By the time Lucas Lundin made his $100 million pledge to the Clinton Foundation, the Congo operation was making the company staggering profits. But for the profits to remain staggering, U.S. policy needed to remain unchanged. The 2006 Congo Relief, Security, and Democracy Promotion Act, which Hillary had co-sponsored, placed those investments at serious risk because they threatened to overturn the political leadership in the country. What benefited Lundin was the status quo in Congo. That status quo was preserved by Hillary's disappointing failure as Secretary of State to implement any of the key provisions in the law that she had strongly advocated only a few years earlier, before Lundin made his contribution. According to a July 2012 article in Foreign Policy, the law had real teeth and empowered the Secretary of State to intervene in a number of important ways. Yet, for reasons unknown, Hillary chose not to do so. This failure to act could at best be described as a sin of omission, though it is a sin compounded by her many promises as a senator to bring real change to the DRC. But Hillary was apparently willing to intervene directly when other well-connected mining companies saw their interests threatened, including foreign mining companies she had no real reason to support. In 2009, a DRC government commission claimed that a Canadian company called First Quantum Minerals Limited had won a lucrative concession for a Lanshi mine, worth $1 billion Canadian, through questionable methods. According to the commission, First Quantum won the Lanshi concession without any competitive bidding. The company had allegedly offered cash payments and shares to some government officials to get it. DRC officials wanted to cancel the contract and suspend the company's license. But according to Le Monde Diplomatique, a prominent French publication, Hillary intervened and tried to pressure the government to restore the company's license. In January 2012, First Quantum received $1.25 billion for its Congolese assets. Why did the U.S. State Department seek to intervene for a Canadian company doing business in the DRC, especially when 90% of the mine's yield ended up in China? We do not know. But it is certainly worth noting that First Quantum was founded by Canadian businessman Jean-Raymond Boulle, a longtime Clinton friend and benefactor. It was Boulle who had put together the diamond deal in Arkansas back in the 1980s when Bill was governor. Hillary wore one of his diamonds to the Clinton inaugural ball. But Boulle was not the only Clinton donor or ally who was seeking to exploit the DRC's vast mineral wealth. Former NBA star Dikembe Mutombo has worked with the Clinton Global Initiative as a partner and was appointed by Hillary to the State Department's Young African Leaders Initiative in 2010. In October 2011, he was a member of an official State Department delegation to Sudan. The following month, he joined forces with a Hillary presidential campaign bundler named Case LaWall on a $10 million venture to transport 4.5 tons of gold out of the Democratic Republic of Congo. According to a UN report, the deal involved some of the most notorious war criminals on the planet, including individuals operating in the Democratic Republic of Congo and committing serious violations of international law involving the targeting of children or women. LaWall, a Nigerian and devout Muslim who lived in Houston, was the head of CAMAC, or CAMAC, an energy company that did considerable business in Nigeria. He also had a long history with the Clintons. In the 1990s, Bill had appointed LaWall to his Trade Advisory Committee on Africa. When Bill visited Africa in 1998 as president, LaWall accompanied him. LaWall's CAMAC featured on its board former Clinton Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary and former Clinton senior White House official Dr. Lee Patrick Brown. According to a 2012 report in the Atlantic Monthly, LaWall leased a Gulfstream 5 jet from Dallas-based Southlake Aviation and sent his half-brother Mickey LaWall, VP of CAMAC, along with Reagan Mutombo, Dikembe's nephew, and employees from his company to Africa to secure the prize. Also involved was a Texas-based diamond trader named Carlos St. Mary. If all went well, the expected profit was a quick $20 million. All did not go well. The Gulfstream ended up in Goma, Congo. The man they were dealing with to secure the gold was a notorious warlord named Bosco Ntaganda. There are plenty of nefarious criminal leaders in Africa, but Ntaganda belongs near the top of the list. The International Criminal Court indicted him in 2006 for using child soldiers. He was also categorized as a sanctioned individual on the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Asset Control list. The consequences? U.S. citizens doing business with him faced the possibility of up to 20 years in prison. As text messages obtained by UN investigators make clear, Case LaWall knew he was dealing with the notorious Ntaganda. And from the beginning, he knew that the gold was from the DRC. To combat the export of gold by warlords and criminal bands, the DRC government banned unregulated exports of gold out of the country. LaWall denied any involvement in illegal activities. The delegation from LaWall and Mutombo transferred $5 million of the cash and awaited their gold. But then DRC customs officials seized the Gulfstream and arrested everyone on board. The owner of the leased jet, David Desiree, got a call in the dead of night informing him that the $43 million jet was loaded with 10 boxes of gold, but was now being held by authorities in Goma. Detained by Congo authorities for the violation of several laws, LaWall and Mutombo contacted the State Department to get them released. As the Texas diamond trader St. Mary described it in a later legal deposition, he, Mutombo, said that he had lobbied a lot on our behalf with Washington, D.C., and he indicated that Case was quite impressed with his ability to lobby at the U.S. State Department on our behalf, and was surprised at the number of people that he knew because he was the former ambassador to the Congo under the Clinton's administration. They were released from jail following State Department intervention. No one involved has faced criminal charges in the United States. Meanwhile, At the same time that Lukas Lundin made his $100 million commitment to the Clinton Foundation, another major foreign investor with much at stake in Africa was doing the same thing. Less than 3 months after Hillary announced her presidential bid, Bill was in London for a meeting with a reclusive Saudi sheikh named Mohammed Al-Amoudi. Amoudi was the head of a sprawling conglomerate called the Mohammed International Development Research and Organization Companies, or MIDROC, which had extensive interests in Ethiopia, including mines, agriculture, hotels, hospital, steel, and cement. Born in Ethiopia to an Ethiopian mother and a Yemeni father, Amoudi grew up in Saudi Arabia and became the kingdom's second richest man. Much of his wealth derived from his close relationship with Ethiopia's repressive government, which sold him government assets, mines, concessions, and land for deeply discounted prices. An enormous amount of his wealth was tied up with that government, and he took acts likely aimed at helping it stay in power. On May 14, 2007, in a small ceremony, the sheikh announced that he was committing $20 million to the Clinton Foundation. He started things off with a check for $2 million. Amoudi was familiar with the money ways of Washington. His lobbying firm in Washington included Senators George Mitchell, Lloyd Benston, who had been Treasury Secretary when Bill was president, and Bob Dole as paid advisors. In May 2007, when he made his commitment to the Clinton Foundation, the Ethiopia Democracy and Accountability Act, H.R. 2003, had just been introduced by Congressman Donald Payne. The bill quickly acquired 85 co-sponsors in the House and passed on October 2, 2007. The United States was sending hundreds of millions in taxpayer money to Ethiopia every year. The bill called for tying that aid directly to progress on human rights. For Amoudi's interests, a bill pressuring the regime that had given him so much to reform would be a disaster. Amoudi's business interests were protected by the ruling regime in Ethiopia. Indeed, some of his businesses had been purchased at bargain basement prices during the privatization of government assets. A democratic election bringing in new leadership would put them at risk. As the bill moved to the U.S. Senate, many looked to see where Senator Clinton would come down. After all, she was the clear frontrunner for the Democratic presidential nomination at the time and chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee. An Ethiopian human rights organization sent a letter in 2009 to former President Clinton at the Clinton Foundation, warning that the donation was an attempt to influence U.S. policy toward Ethiopia. "We have reason to believe that the huge donation to the Clinton Foundation was made on behalf of the Ethiopian government. Although we believe in philanthropy, there is something troubling with this picture. By all accounts, Sheikh Amoudi, the owner of Ethiopia's famous Sheraton Hotel, is not known for much philanthropy." The letter, a copy of which was also sent to Hillary at the State Department, further noted what observers in other countries had seen. Local AIDS organizations that appealed to the billionaire, Amoudi, for paltry sums were turned down, the Ethiopians wrote to Clinton. "So why would a wealthy man from one of the poorest countries in the world say no to organizations in his country, and yet easily enough cough up $20 million for an American organization 10,000 miles away? Is this just a coincidence that the donation was made at the start of U.S. presidential elections?" The letter also asserted that the Clinton Foundation had a close working relationship with the oppressive government. "The work of the Clinton Foundation in Ethiopia is loosely intertwined with government operations. We urge you to go beyond the government and to seek out independent community organizations that are closely working with the poor." Neither Bill nor the foundation ever responded. Instead, as we will see, when Hillary became Secretary of State, Amoudi's companies received special benefits from the U.S. State Department, including taxpayer funds. Much of Amoudi's wealth came from his relationship with Ethiopia's longtime dictator, Meles Zenawi. A diminutive man with a goatee and arched eyebrows, Zenawi had joined a rebel group fighting the Marxist Mengistu regime. He quickly rose through the ranks. When they seized power in 1991, Zenawi was 36 and became head of the country. It is hard to overstate how closely Amoudi's wealth was tied with Zenawi's rule in Ethiopia. When Zenawi died in 2012 of a mysterious stomach ailment, Amoudi would say, "I lost my right hand." Amoudi had been able to buy 70% of Ethiopia's National Oil Corporation from the government. One of the sheikh's companies, Saudi Star, was given leases on tens of thousands of acres of Ethiopian land. The sheikh controls Ethiopia's steel production, and as the country's exclusive gold exporter with one of his mines, also purchased from the government, producing more than 10,000 pounds of gold and silver per year. Zenawi's policies pushed local people off their lands, decimated forests, and encroached on game reserves. The list of his offenses is immense, reported in Britain's prestigious The Lancet, including politically manipulating the foreign aid the United States and other countries provide. Badly needed food and agricultural aid that had been given by foreign donors was being denied to hungry village communities not allied with the ruling party. Zenawi was a shrewd technocrat, known for imprisoning his political opponents, withholding development assistance from restive areas, stealing elections, and cracking down on civil society NGOs. He sentenced journalists, including two Europeans, to lengthy jail terms. As The Atlantic put it, from a human rights perspective, Zenawi's rule has been abusive, heavy-handed, and self-interested. On the plus side, under his rule, Ethiopia also experienced rapid economic growth, and it was this economic growth that had led Bill Clinton to praise him as part of a new generation of African leaders. Zenawi's ability to curry favor with some in the West while being a brutal dictator at home led one observer to note, "He was a charmer in Geneva and London. He was a stern, even brutal autocrat at home." Despite his mixed record, many in the West, including the Clintons, embraced and legitimized him. According to a leaked State Department cable, in 2007, on his way to attend the G20 summit in Pittsburgh, Zenawi was invited to attend Clinton Foundation events in New York. When Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State in January 2009, Ethiopian officials interacted confidently with U.S. diplomats. Despite public statements coming from Washington about promoting human rights in Ethiopia and Africa, Ethiopian officials remained unfazed. In February 2010, Hillary's Undersecretary of State Maria Otero met with the dictator and raised questions about the plight and arrest of an opposition figure named Bertukan Medexa. Zenawi told her that Medexa will vegetate in jail forever, according to leaked State Department cables obtained through WikiLeaks. As far as opposition groups were concerned, he said, "We will crush them with our full force." It was a shocking display of disrespect, given that the United States was sending his government $500 million a year. As Foreign Affairs put it, "Washington has expressed its concern about these issues to the Ethiopian government, and the Ethiopian government has reacted not only negatively, but also insultingly, despite receiving $533 million in U.S. assistance in fiscal year 2010. Zenawi aggressively went after not only domestic political opponents, but also American organizations like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and Jimmy Carter's Carter Center that were working in the country. According to another WikiLeaks State Department cable, diplomats raised concerns with Zenawi about his new policy, requiring organizations like U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Carter Center to seek government approval to use U.S. money sent from the United States in Ethiopia. Zenawi said, as far as the Carter Center was concerned, "Maybe we are better off if they do not come." He was equally dismissive when diplomats raised questions about how the government restricted access to Western food aid in certain regions for political reasons. In 2012, Ethiopia was among the top sub-Saharan African recipients of U.S. aid, with $707 million in planned aid. As Secretary of State, Hillary was required to evaluate whether countries receiving American aid were transparent in how the money was spent. The Department of State, Foreign Operations, and Related Programs Appropriation Act prohibits U.S. assistance to the central government of any country that does not meet minimum standards of fiscal transparency. Unless, that is, Hillary decided to grant the country a waiver. State Department officials determined that Ethiopia failed to meet the transparency requirement, according to leaked cables from the embassy. Ethiopia does not, however, have specific laws or regulations governing the public disclosure or revenues and expenditures in national budgets. There are no independent auditors of government budget data, so information is taken at face value. International economists generally focus their criticism on the number of extra-budgetary items that are omitted from the national budget. Notably, the national budget does not include over 100 state-owned enterprises or the over 70 endowment companies owned by the ruling political party. The list of offenses continued and concluded by noting, "In the past year, there have not been any events that affected Ethiopia's budget transparency, and the government of Ethiopia has not made any steps toward improving its fiscal transparency. When U.S. diplomats asked the Ethiopian Minister of Finance about the national budget, he maintained that he does not have access to complete books either. Diplomats raised the message to GOE, Government of Ethiopia officials, regarding Ethiopia's need to comply with USG, U.S. government fiscal transparency guidelines. However, this message has fallen on deaf ears and only seems to aggravate relations. Despite the lack of compliance and the apparent lack of interest in moving toward transparency, Hillary granted the government of Ethiopia a waiver, which allowed it to avoid transparency requirements. Someone who has directly benefited from U.S. assistance to Ethiopia is Sheikh Amudi. Amudi owned Ethiopia's Dashen Bank, which he used to finance his other companies and projects. According to Dashen's annual reports, the bank reaps financial reward through the USAID's Development Credit Authority, which is funded by U.S. taxpayers and provides Ethiopian loan guarantees. The USAID also brokered a long-term contract in November 2009 specifically for Almeida Textiles, which is owned by Amudi, to import textiles into the United States. When Hillary was appointed Secretary of State, she brought in a group of advisors to shape American policy toward Africa. But two individuals largely responsible for forming it didn't have a direct portfolio at State. Husband Bill was considered to be Hillary's closest Africa advisor. He had good contacts with several African presidents and traveled there regularly. The other key unofficial advisor was former Ambassador Joe Wilson, regarded as Hillary's gray eminence for Africa. Wilson had served as ambassador to several countries in Africa. In 1997, he was appointed special assistant to President Clinton and senior director for African affairs in the White House. Wilson had the responsibility to plan and execute then-President Bill Clinton's first trip to Africa, which supposedly raised his consciousness concerning the continent. Wilson is perhaps most famous for the role he played in a controversy involving his wife, Valerie Plame, a former CIA agent who had been outed by officials in the Bush administration. Wilson charged that this was an intentional act of retaliation against him for debunking the administration's claims about Saddam Hussein's seeking yellowcake uranium in Africa. It later turned out that the leak of Plame's identity came from the State Department, not the White House. Nevertheless, husband and wife made something of a career out of the episode. Plame published a book about her experience, which in turn became a movie starring Sean Penn and Naomi Watts. Wilson's claims about the yellowcake uranium were later debunked by the Senate Intelligence Committee. Wilson was close to the Clintons. He was very active with the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign, his wife noted. Wilson penned articles declaring that, in contrast with then-Senator Obama, Hillary had real-world diplomatic experience. On the campaign trail in Portland, Oregon, in April 2008, he said that Hillary was easily the better candidate. Joe Wilson also traveled with Bill Clinton to Africa as part of a Clinton Foundation delegation. Once Hillary was nominated for Secretary of State, many believed she wanted to appoint Wilson to a senior State Department post for African affairs. But the reality of facing a difficult Senate confirmation deterred her. Many Republicans strongly disliked him. Still, Wilson was a strong presence at the State Department, despite his lack of an official post. Wilson's presence in the wings is still strongly felt, and the future incumbent in this post will constantly have him under their feet, noted one African business publication. In January 2007, Wilson became vice chairman of a New York-based investment firm called Jarch Capital, a holding company focused on natural resources like oil, uranium, and gold. It specialized in cutting deals in countries where it expected sovereignty changes. That's a nice way of saying countries that are at war. Ambassador Wilson will be instrumental in the growth of Jarch as it expands in Africa, sometimes in politically sensitive areas, noted the company in a press release. In other words, like Adolf Lundin did in Congo, Jarch would be striking deals with warlords fighting local governments, hoping to cash in when power changed hands. As Jarch founder Philippe Heilberg, a former Wall Street banker, explained his strategy for cutting deals with warlords, "You have to go to the guns. This is Africa." The venture was clearly off the grid as far as the Bush State Department was concerned. As Harper's quoted a knowledgeable observer in 2007, The State Department isn't supportive of Jarch's involvement because it knows that once Americans go after oil in the South, any hope of a national unity government collapses. But Jarch Capital pressed on anyway. Wilson was of particular help because he had dealt with Sudanese warlords while he had served in the Clinton administration. He knew the region, and he was a master negotiator. These skills proved extremely valuable to Jarch. Jarch was close to several warlords operating in the Sudan. In 2009, shortly after Hillary was appointed to Secretary of State, Jarch took out a 50-year lease on 400,000 hectares, or 1 million acres, about the size of Vermont, in Unity State, South Sudan. In addition to the rights to farm the land, it procured oil and uranium rights as well. As the Financial Times put it, the deal had a decidedly 19th-century flavor to it. Sudan was in the middle of a civil war, and the United States had placed restrictions on U.S. companies wanting to do business in the country. So, Jarch set up a subsidiary, Jarch Management, which was registered outside the United States, making it easier to circumvent such restrictions. Jarch acquired the land by striking a bargain with Gabriel Matip, the eldest son of General Paulino Matip Nihal, who was deputy commander-in-chief of the Sudan People's Liberation Army, SPLA, and former head of the South Sudan Defense Force, SSDF. The general was also put on the Jarch Advisory Board. SSDF bragged, "This company is set to become the largest producer of oil and gas in South Sudan." Wilson's firm continued signing up warlords and enriching their family members in exchange for lucrative leases on rebel-held territory. In 2010, it signed up Sudanese General Gabriel Tenginya as an advisor and leased a huge area of his native Jonglei state in what was called Africa's largest land deal. Tenginya, who has been accused of instigating violence against civilians in southern Sudan, was apparently a very welcome addition to the firm. Jarch declared that General Tenginya will give the company much-needed expertise in Jonglei and expand its expertise in Greater Upper Nile. By the time there were national elections in 2011, the newly minted vice president of South Sudan was Riek Machar, who was also an advisor to Jarch. Machar had been a rebel leader and later apologized for his role in the Boer massacre, in which thousands of people had been killed. As South Sudan struggles with factional fighting following its independence in 2011, Jarch capital-linked warlords are in the thick of the fight. General Peter Gadet, a former member of the Jarch Capital Advisory Board, is the target of international sanctions. According to the BBC, the international sanctions are in response to reports of atrocities committed in the first half of 2014. The cluster of donors and advisors to the Clintons who rely on warlords and corrupt dictators is not confined to the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, or Sudan. It extends further south on the continent and includes a longtime Clinton benefactor with close ties to the corrupt regime in Nigeria. Nigeria is widely recognized as one of the most corrupt countries in the world. It has also been one of the most lucrative countries for the Clintons. Over the course of more than 15 years, they have collected large speaking fees, campaign-related funds, and large contributions for the Clinton Foundation from those who have made large fortunes by working in the corrupt world of Nigerian politics. In his first 8 years on the global lecture circuit, Bill had never been paid to speak in Nigeria. But once Hillary was appointed Secretary of State, he booked two of his top three highest-paid speeches ever by traveling to Nigeria, pulling in a whopping $700,000 each. The two speeches were allegedly underwritten by Nigerian media mogul Nduka Obegbena, who owns Nigeria's This Day newspaper. Obegbena, a solidly built man with a taste for bespoke Lanvin suits, professes to live modestly and discreetly, all the while maintaining a home in Lagos, a large estate in Nigeria's Delta State, and a sleek penthouse at the Ritz-Carlton in Washington, D.C. Obegbena casts himself as a rebel fighting Nigeria's corrupt political establishment, but he's known more for his lavish parties and concerts, which have brought Beyoncé and Jay-Z, as well as Bill Clinton, to Nigeria at enormous expense. Often these lavish events come at a price for ordinary Nigerians. When Clinton appeared at a This Day award event in 2013, he handed out checks to school teachers as a reward for their work. But while Clinton collected his fee, the teachers saw their checks from This Day bounce. Obegbena is close to the Nigerian government of President Goodluck Jonathan, to whom he serves as an unofficial advisor. Jonathan has been accused of corruption by numerous international organizations. As the Associated Press puts it, Obegbena has close ties to major business leaders and those in the ruling People's Democratic Party. Hillary's State Department said that Jonathan's tenure is marked by massive, widespread, and pervasive corruption at all levels of the Nigerian government. And yet, as with Ethiopia, Hillary granted the country a waiver for corruption so it could continue to receive U.S. assistance. Back in 2006, when Jonathan was the governor of Bayelsa State, he authorized the transfer of $1 million from the government's Poverty Alleviation Fund to Obegbena's organization so he could bring Beyoncé to Nigeria. One longtime Clinton benefactor is businessman Gilbert Chagoury, who has also been implicated in corruption and bribery in Nigeria. Born in Lagos, Chagoury comes from a Lebanese family and has dual citizenship in Lebanon and the United Kingdom. He built a financial empire in Nigeria with the help of General Sani Abacha, a Nigerian dictator whose five-year tenure was known for its corruption and brutality. Chagoury served as a front for the general's extensive business empire, and the two had a business partner in their activities, Mark Rich, the fugitive oil and commodities broker. Chagoury apparently worked with Rich to sop up oil assets in Nigeria and sell them on the oil market for the benefit of General Abacha and his associates. The Nigerian media declared in 1999 that the Gilbert Chagoury-Mark Rich alliance remains a formidable foe. Abacha and Chagoury met when the future dictator was a young army officer. After Abacha carried out a coup in 1993, Chagoury received prized oil concessions and government construction contracts. In exchange, Chagoury helped the general siphon off money and get it out of the country. Abacha's rule was highly criticized in Washington, where hundreds of millions of dollars in foreign assistance were disappearing into European bank accounts. During his rule, Abacha funneled billions of dollars to foreign bank accounts. Nigeria's lead anti-corruption prosecutor at the time, Nuhu Ribadu, put Chagoury at the center of the scheme. "You couldn't investigate corruption without looking at Chagoury," he said. According to Ribadu, Chagoury helped steer more than $4 billion into bank accounts in Switzerland, Luxembourg, Liechtenstein, and the Isle of Jersey. Recognizing that it helped to have highly placed friends in Washington, Chagoury started funneling money to the 1996 Clinton re-election campaign and the Democratic National Committee. He contributed $460,000 to a Miami-based voter registration group tied to the DNC. Because Chagoury is not an American citizen, he is unable to legally contribute directly to a campaign. As the Washington Post put it, the nearly $500,000 contribution was given to curry favor with the Clinton's administration on Abacha's behalf. Apparently, it worked. In 1996, Chagoury and his wife attended the White House Christmas party. More significantly, Bill effectively changed U.S. policy toward Nigeria with a single sentence. The United States government had been pressuring Abacha to step down and hold elections. Abacha was expected to go, but President Clinton said in 1998, "If Abacha stands for election, we hope he will stand as a civilian." In short, Clinton signaled that Abacha could stay. He simply needed to run as a civilian. The New York Times called it a shift in U.S. policy. When Abacha died in 1998, allegedly in the company of two prostitutes, the Nigerian government and European authorities began investigating the missing money. They quickly fingered Chagoury. In 2000, he was convicted in Geneva, Switzerland, of money laundering and aiding a criminal organization in connection with the billions of dollars stolen from Nigeria during the Abacha years, as PBS Frontline put it. As part of a plea deal, the conviction was later expunged. Chagoury cut a deal with the Nigerians and Swiss, returning $300 million of his own profits in exchange for legal immunity. Subsequently, the tiny island state of St. Lucia appointed him as its envoy to the United Nations Education, Social, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, bringing him diplomatic immunity and preventing prosecution in other European countries. Why St. Lucia bestowed this honor on him is unclear. Chagoury's apparent complicity in the looting of Nigeria by a brutal dictator might be enough to deter most people from doing business with him, but not the Clintons. If anything, their relationship has blossomed. Clinton has recently been described as Chaguerie's close friend. Since his conviction in Europe, Chaguerie has donated millions to the Clinton Foundation. In 2009, shortly after Hillary became Secretary of State, he pledged a whopping $1 billion to the Clintons' Legacy Project. During a speech Bill delivered in St. Lucia, the island's prime minister extended thanks to Chaguerie for arranging the visit. He was also an invited guest to Bill's 60th birthday party and attended the wedding of Bill's longtime aide, Doug Band. The Chaguerie's were also active in Hillary's 2008 presidential bid. Michel Chaguerie, a nephew in Los Angeles, was a bundler for the campaign and served on the campaign staff. Numerous other relatives gave the maximum $4,600 each to her campaign. Chaguerie's legal troubles continued. In April 2010, Gilbert Chaguerie and his brother Jack were indicted by the U.S. Justice Department in a massive bribery scandal involving $6 billion and Halliburton. Bribes had allegedly been paid to secure contracts in Nigeria. Eventually, Chaguerie and his brother were dropped from the case, and Halliburton settled with the federal government for $35 million. Bill has lavished praise on Chaguerie over the years. In 2005, Chaguerie was presented with the Pride of Heritage Award from the Lebanese community by Bill. And in 2009, the Clinton Global Initiative gave Chaguerie's company an award for sustainable development. In 2013, Bill showed up in Nigeria for a public ceremony involving one of Chaguerie's construction projects. Why the Clintons continue to associate with, take money from, and have transactions with Gilbert Chaguerie remains a mystery. No less an expert than Mark Rich, who had years of experience working with Chaguerie and Nigeria, once described the country as the global capital of corruption. The Clinton Foundation has made its work in Africa a centerpiece of its global work on HIV/AIDS and development. Unfortunately, many of those who are paying it and providing it with funds have profited off the worst excesses on the continent. One has to wonder why the Clintons would permit themselves to be so closely tied to such a corrupt group of individuals. Chapter 9. Rainforest Riches. Hillary, Bill, and Colombian timber and oil deals. In early June 2010, Bill Clinton met Frank Giustra in Colombia to launch a $20 million fund for small businesses. The two had visited Colombia together numerous times, for paid speeches, to look in on Giustra's growing investments there, and to launch a Clinton Foundation project in the country. Giustra was invested in natural resources in Colombia, and he was looking to expand his holdings in oil, natural gas, coal, and timber. The country had been plagued by violence and narco-terrorism for decades and was slowly coming out of it, thanks in part to a large infusion of American foreign aid. Colombia was the fourth largest recipient of U.S. foreign military aid in the world. It was also desperate to get a free trade agreement passed in the United States to jumpstart its economy. What that meant was that Hillary, as Secretary of State, held much of the country's future in her hands. And as some unseen power of timing would have it, Hillary was set to arrive in Colombia the very next day. In her memoirs, Hillary called the fact that she and her husband were both in the country a happy coincidence in our hectic schedules. It was the waning weeks of Colombian President Alvaro Uribe's tenure in office. The thin, bespectacled Uribe had first been elected in 2002 on a platform of fighting terrorism and violence. When he took office, he later wrote, "Vast swaths of Colombia were under total domination of the narco-terroristas." For Uribe, the fight was personal. His father had been killed by Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC, or FARC, terrorists in the 1980s. During his 8 years in office, he had achieved an impressive record of success. But term limits prevented him from running again. He tried holding a popular referendum that would get him another term, but Colombian courts rejected it. He would be out of office by August 2010, but still had substantial powers until the next election. Hillary was popping over to Bogota from nearby Ecuador aboard a U.S. government plane. After her aircraft touched down at Colombia's Catam military airport, she was greeted by U.S. Ambassador William Brownfield and Colombian Foreign Minister Jaime Bermudez. Hillary expressed her strong support for the Uribe government and closer ties with Colombia. "The United States will continue to support the Colombian people, the Colombian military, and their government in the ongoing struggle against the insurgents," the guerrillas, the narco-traffickers who had wished to turn the clock back, she said. These were not meaningless niceties. Only a couple of months earlier, three influential Democratic senators, who were also Hillary's friends, had written to her about cutting aid to Colombia. Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, Chris Dodd of Connecticut, and Patrick Leahy of Vermont had penned a letter saying it was time to back away. Given U.S. record budget deficits, we cannot afford to continue assistance that is not achieving sufficient results, they wrote. They also dinged a rebate on human rights. In particular, they said, human rights abuses by Colombian military personnel supported by the U.S. continue, and those responsible are rarely brought to justice. Nor were they alone. Foreign aid for Colombia was never a popular subject among Democrats, who were worried about human rights and labor rights conditions in the country. From the airport, Hillary headed into Bogota and met Bill at a restaurant in the northern part of the city. With a few friends, it is unclear if Justra was also there, they enjoyed cappuccinos and a steak dinner. The next morning, June 9th, Bill headed to Casa de Nariño, the presidential palace, for a quiet meeting with President Uribe. They met for approximately an hour and had what the media called an animated dialogue. Bill left Casa de Nariño before noon. Hillary arrived for lunch with the president, after which they signed a series of science and technology agreements. Most importantly for Uribe, Hillary also lent her vocal support to a trade agreement between the United States and Colombia. First, let me underscore President Obama's and my commitment to the free trade agreement, she told RCN television. We are going to continue to work to obtain the votes in the Congress to be able to pass it. We think it's strongly in the interests of both Colombia and the United States, and I return very invigorated to begin a very intensive effort to try to obtain the votes to get the free trade agreement finally ratified. Uribe could not have been more pleased. It is also worth noting that her support for this agreement represented a complete reversal of her position, and Obama's, from the 2008 campaign. Days after Hillary left Bogota, Prima Colombia Properties, which Frank Justra has ownership interest in through a shell company called Flagship Industries, announced that it had acquired the right to cut timber in a biologically diverse forest on the pristine Colombian shoreline. The International Tropical Timber Organization, ITTO, calls this property one of the world's largest untapped hardwood timber supplies. Through its Colombia-domiciled subsidiary, REM International CISA, Prima entered into an exclusive agreement with the Colombian government, giving it the right to harvest 1,050,000 cubic meters of hardwood on the west coast of Colombia. The timber would be cut along picturesque Huaca Beach in Choco and shipped to China. Days later, Pacific Rubiales Energy, a company for which Justra was the Canadian face, announced that the Uribe government was giving the company the right to drill for oil on six lucrative plots. Pacific Rubiales acquired the largest exploration acreage in the Putumayo Basin, which sits at the center of Colombia's oil belt. The other plots were in the giant reserves east of Cusiana-Cupiagua and three blocks in the Llanos Basin, a prolific oil-rich area at the foot of the Andes Mountains. It was a stunning success, given that Pacific Rubiales was a relatively new company with little track record in the country. But these lucrative concessions helped the company grow quickly. As German Hernandez, who oversees business operations for the company, explained in 2011, "A few years ago, we were fewer than 20 people, practically living in tents with mosquito netting. Today, we are the number one project in the petroleum industry in Colombia." By the end of 2010, the company was producing a net of 70,000 barrels of oil equivalent per day in Colombia and boasted a market cap of over $8.3 billion. According to Pacific Rubiales co-chairman Serafino Iacono, Justra's role at the company is to provide valuable financial capital and political capital, emphasis added, along the way. Pacific Rubiales signed up as an early contributor to the Clinton Foundation. Pacific Rubiales and underwriters contributed over $4 million to the Clinton-Justra Sustainable Growth Initiative, CGSGI. And as we have seen in several other cases, the company's decision to give to a charity thousands of miles away to fund work in Colombia struck local charities as odd. They, along with labor-backed social welfare organizations, had been clamoring for the company to provide donations for several health and welfare initiatives. They also wanted the company to raise the salaries of employees. These efforts were rebuffed. Instead of flowing to local charities, the bulk of the company's charitable contributions were given instead to the Clinton Foundation. Pacific Rubiales, despite its announced commitment, does not appear on the Clinton Foundation list of donors. Repeated phone calls and emails to Pacific Rubiales to determine whether it honored their commitment have not been returned as of this writing. Giustra's run of good business news in the summer of 2010 was not finished. Less than 2 weeks after Hillary left, yet another of Giustra's companies, Petro America, announced that Colombian regulators had designated the company a